The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 215.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He might not be the Rebel Capitalist, but he is the Rebel Economist. His name is Steve Keen. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, George.
Now, it's been probably a year since I've had the opportunity to interview you. So for my guests who might not know your full backstory, can you get us up to speed there?
Okay. Well, I think probably the main thing is if I could point the right direction. That's the main book I'm known, or a book called Debunking Economics. That's where my Rebel Economist claim comes from. And I've been an economist, professional economist for 35 years, a Rebel Economist for 50, ever since I was a student, when I was helped to see through the mainstream neoclassical way of thinking. I then did the same myself to standard Marxian economics. So I've been trying to develop realistic economics ever since, and to trash the nonsense, the ideology coming at one extreme from cardboard cutout Marxism, as I call it, and the other extreme from the neoclassicals, who eulogize capitalism for characteristics it does not have, which if it did have, it wouldn't be strengths in the first place. It leaves out the real strengths of capitalism and totally misanalyzes it. But it looks plausible enough for people to swallow, and that's the danger, for the same reason they swallowed Ptolemy's epicycles explanation for the solar system, because it could tell them where the planets had been next year, but it was completely wrong about the structure of the universe. That's my opinion of neoclassical economics. Plausible and a completely wrong description of capitalism.
Yeah, so I got two questions on that. First, we've talked before, and I'll maybe share with my viewers at the end of the interview kind of a funny story. But yeah. We talked recently.
Very recently. Yeah, it feels like just days, really.
Yeah, funny how that happens. So this is Steve Keen 2.0. But when we talked before, you said there was something that kind of was your epiphany moment. You use the example of this yin yang. And can you walk us through that story? That was fascinating.
Okay. Well, if you think about neoclassical economics, the vision that comes to mind of anybody done any study at all is a pair of intersecting lines. Supply and demand intersect at a particular point. They give you quantity and price. And that's so prevalent in economics, it was actually called the totem of economics in a wonderful satirical article by a fantastic author called Axel Leonhofer that I recommend people to search for, Life Among the Econ. When you applied that to the labor market, it argued that the best possible situation was to have competitive workers, so no unions, facing competitive employers, so no employer associations. And that'd give you the best possible outcome. The wage would reflect the marginal product of labor, as they call it. In other words, people would get paid what they deserve. So it's a meritocratic equilibrium analysis of the labor market. And then in the middle of first year, my first year lecturer, who'd already had the wool pulled off his eyes, explained a piece of conventional economic theory called the theory of the second best. Now, I think it won a Nobel Prize for one of its inventors. This question asked, what happens if you're not one step away from perfection? If you're one step from perfection, it's easy. You step to perfection. Okay? What if you're two steps away? And so the example that he gave was when you had both a trade union and a collection of employers, of organized labor, organized capital, bargaining over the wage. In that situation, what you got, there were two other curves you could draw called the marginal revenue product and the marginal supply product. Those two curves, and there was actually a range where the wage could fall, and it depended largely on bargaining power. Now, the theory showed, and this was explained to me in this first year lecture, I think it was in July of 1971, if you abolished either the union or the employers' association, you got the worst outcome. The worst outcome was where you were the very top curve or the very bottom, these 2 points of an intersection. If you had only a union or only the employers, you either got the top or the bottom, not the range in the middle. So one side was screwing the other.
Right.
Okay. And therefore, getting rid of either unions or employer associations would make the world worse. And firstly, that was one reason that I, shortly after I started working in a part-time job, when I was a total critic of unions before that lecture, I joined the union on my first day, working in a wine factory, as it happens. But more importantly, I remember sitting back in my chair in the university thinking, this is crazy. This is something that I believe was incontrovertible, that abolishing unions was a good thing, okay, was made to seem dangerously misleading simply by acknowledging that there weren't just unions, there were also employer associations.
Yeah, right.
So it's acknowledging reality. And suddenly, when you acknowledge that reality is slightly more complicated than your simplistic models, you then find yourself reversing the advice that model gives you. Rather than saying you should get rid of the union, it said, no, you've got to get both the written and the employer organization. Yeah, otherwise, right, You'll make the world worse off. And I thought, that's silly. I mean, you can't, you know, suddenly reform every mistake and every imperfection, as neoclassical economists would call it. You can't get rid of them all overnight. Getting rid of one makes things worse. And I thought, there's got to be something wrong with the theory. And that's the day that I looked in the textbook for an explanation of this theory. It wasn't there. I went down to the library thinking, I'm not being told the full story here. And I started getting journals off the shelves. Right. And at that point, I realized that there'd been, like, I was in 1971. Starting pretty much in 1960, there'd been a major dispute over how you define capital in terms of you measure it. How do you measure how many machines you have? And that debate did not turn up at all in my textbook, even though Paul Samuelson conceded defeat in that debate in 1966. Now, I had his textbook. He made no mention of it. And I thought, I'm being lied to by the textbooks. And that's when I started reading the original source material and finding that what looks so solid, if you only learn the textbook version, what you're getting is a sanitized, mendacious explanation of the literature, leaving out the crucial material that questions the simplistic beliefs that flow from it. So that's when I became a critic.
You know, I want to talk about echo chambers and maybe through the lens of economics, but I just see it in today's society everywhere. And it's not just echo chambers. It's a narrative that's repeated over and over and over and over again to the point where no one even questions it. But there's been no critical thinking to try to poke holes in the narrative, just because people believe it has to be true because you hear it so often in the media. And then you combine that with an echo chamber on steroids, which is social media, because Facebook or Instagram, whatever, these algorithms are set up so that you only follow the people you agree with. And then so you hear that message reinforced over and over and over again. So number one, how is this dangerous in economics? How have you been able to remove yourself from the echo chamber? And then today, as we speak, how do you continually make sure that you're not putting yourself in another echo chamber and you're always critically thinking through your own belief system?
Well, I think in terms of how I managed to avoid the echo chamber, I think I've got to give a certain amount of my past history there. I went to a Catholic school in Australia. The Catholics, the teachers were the Maris brothers, who were a quite conservative religious order. And the general tenor of the Catholic political parties in Australia, called the Democratic Labor Party, was anti-communist. So they pushed all this reds under the bed, yellow peril, where the idea that gravity was going to cause the Vietnamese to flow down through Indonesia and New Guinea and into Australia if we didn't stop them in Vietnam or fight them in China, preferably. So I had all this stuff being pushed at me. So I began with that framework. And the one thing that I couldn't cope with was the idea that I was going to be conscripted to fight for freedom. And just like this curly thing in the economic theory that didn't make sense, the theory of the second best, how can you be compelled to fight for freedom? So I started researching historical literature on the Indo-Chinese conflict, and I realized fairly rapidly that it wasn't communists versus capitalists. Mm-hmm. It was nationalists versus colonial invaders. The Communist Party had been the main force driving the French out of Vietnam. When the Second World War occurred. The French promised to return sovereignty to the Vietnamese if they cooperated against the Japanese. They reneged on that deal. Then the war started. Then America came in. When the French got pushed out, the Americans came in on the side of the Vietnamese allied with the French. So you had a civil war, which America injected it into. So in all the middle of all this, I just found that I couldn't trust the conventional narratives. Right. I had to go and read the source literature. And that became my habit all the way through. So like in terms of my academic reading, I read textbooks for the fun of pointing out where they lie fundamentally. But I read the original sources as much as I can. And I was lucky, as well as being skeptical of mainstream economics, I was skeptical of Marxism as well. So a lot of what I found with a lot of people, when they ended up rejecting the neoclassical way of thinking, they went to the Marxian way.
Right.
And I mentioned the religious thing. Because the church was in favor of the Vietnam War, the right wing side part of the church, I found myself questioning my religion. So I became agnostic. And I went from being a believer to being a non-believer. Now, at the same time, I remember meeting one of my lefty colleagues at university many, many, many years later on a bus, and he talked about the day that he found Marx. And my response, my feeling, I didn't say it to him, of course, because he's a nice guy, but I thought, this is religion.
Right.
So people have a tendency to fall for belief systems. And we see ourselves as being a scientific species, but I think fundamentally we're a belief promulgating species. And the difference with science is that you have beliefs which you can actually empirically contradict, not because you try to, you actually try to confirm those beliefs, but the empirical attempt to prove them fails. And then out of that, over time, you get a change in belief. So I've got a very strong science orientation to my way of thinking. I didn't do physics at the university. I did it to very high school level initially. And if I hadn't had 6 years of lousy science teachers, I might have been a physicist rather than an economist. So I suppose that helps. In terms of echo chambers, I saw so much of it in the left-wing groups that I became part of to fight the right-wing economics I was being taught. So as well as being critical of the mainstream economics, I could just see this, you know, lefty behavior. We even had a personality cult at one stage around one of the leaders of the progressive group. And because I'd rejected the idea of a belief in a belief system like a religion, I found it easier to step outside that. And the other thing is that I'm fairly social, although a lot of economists and academics are not particularly social. And one of my best friends ended up being a guy who employed me at a sheet metal factory. And I remember telling my lefty friend, that is a good mate of mine, Maury Cameron, and they said, how can you be friends with a capitalist? And my reaction was, okay, so when the revolution comes, how are you going to work out who you like after the revolution if you can't work it out beforehand, except then whether they're pro or anti-capitalist? So all that stuff gives me a skeptical foundation, and I try to sustain that. But often the real way to do it is, see if somebody believes something, then research and see how they've justified those beliefs. And that's what, for example, led me to seeing the work of William Nordhaus, the guy who got the Nobel Prize in 2018, a complete fraud, in my opinion. And it's not an opinion. I can back it up with having read his articles and seeing where he makes fundamentally fraudulent statements about science. So, I think I've tried to stick with it. And I try to have friends across political and social boundaries as well.
Yeah, so I know you're more an economist, but when you're talking about religion, I just read an article the other day, and their claim, it wasn't like this is fact, it was just kind of a thought experiment, and they were talking about the decline in the popularity of religion in the United States over the past, let's say, two or three decades. Yep. And their hypothesis...
Line, that's from an outsider's position, that's quite amazing. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, their hypothesis was a lot of these stocks you see as, we'll call them quote-unquote cult stocks, where the people just flat out won't sell. You know, they've got diamond hands, let's say. And so maybe a Tesla would fall into that category. They argued that this is just a way for people to replace that void that they have from religion, and also why we've become so divisive in the United States from a political standpoint, is people have adopted, whether it's a battle cry for green energy with Tesla, or maybe the left or the right or whatever, this is their new form of religion. And when you hear them talking about it, they use words that are very similar to what you saw with real diehard religious folks, all 100, 200, 300 years ago. So, and I know you're more of an economist, but from an investment side, do you see that happening there, that investors are falling into that trap?
Well, I think, again, it is just another manifestation of the fact that we are belief-sharing creatures.
Yeah, and tribal. This is,
all the way through. I mean, if you you look at the classic Charles Mackay, popular delusions and the madness of crowds, that we share beliefs, we always have, and they manifest themselves in the stock market with people taking positions which are normally based on emotion and what the herd believes rather than necessarily, dispassionate analysis, which is the way the neoclassicals try to describe it, with themselves having a belief system about how the market actually functions, which is itself absurd, But I think the fundamental point about humanity is that we are beliefs. We if you imagine like the first two apes with enough intelligence to actually hold a conversation and a language, obviously, to share it, lying back at night, looking up at the stars, what do you think they are? And then you get a belief system about what the stars are. Mm-hmm. And we then share those beliefs. But more importantly, as a population, we can share beliefs about, for example, invincibility against lions or, that we can cooperate because of our beliefs. And that gives us enormous power against other species. So our beliefs are what got us to the position of dominance on the planet. Right. But they are now probably the main threat to our continued existence on the planet.
Yeah, very interesting thought there. Steve, what do you think of the efficient market hypothesis or theory?
I think probably the person who thought that up was probably either on mescaline, maybe cocaine, possibly a mixture of LSD.
The above.
You have to go and read this stuff in the original to see where it comes from. Because efficient is a nice word, we'd like things to be efficient. And it's part of the way they steal ordinary language and pervert it. But the guy who wrote that paper is a guy called William Sharp. He wrote a paper called Capital Pricing Under Risk, I've forgotten the actual direct title, in 1964. And what he built was a model of an individual investor who had a choice of a riskless asset, so an asset giving you the pure interest rate, pretty much you can imagine government bonds there, right, and being able to invest in a range of speculative assets, which of course are shares, and he had the shares having an expected return, which of course is that their own investors' estimates. So some investor might say Tesla is going to really outperform. Mother might say, no, it's going to crash and IBM's going to outperform. So it's this person's individual beliefs about how much, what the return will be on one axis and what the standard deviation of that return will be on the other axis. That was how he captured risk. And there was a straight line drawn from the point zero volatility, of course, because when you buy a bond, it's going to yield 2%. That's your fixed zero volatility one. Drew a line up to the edge of this cloud of IBM's here and Tesla's there and, General Motors is there, et cetera, and you get the point of tangency, and then the investor can choose to be right down 100% in the riskless asset, or they can be 100% in shares, or they can borrow money and leave their share position. So it was a plausible, if a bit extreme, model of an individual investor. Now, he then had to get from that individual to the market. What he said, I assume, and wait for this, homogeneity of investor expectations. Investors are assumed to agree on all the characteristics of shares mentioned. If you and I are having a conversation about Tesla, I'd ask you what you think the expected return of Tesla P is going to be. You'd say 7.3%. I'd say, wow, I think it's going to be 7.3% too. And what about the dollar? Oh, I'd say about 12% standard deviation. Yeah, I think it's going to be 12% as well. So we all sit around a dinner party having avid conversations, completely agreeing with it, which is utter fucking bullshit.
Okay? Right.
He simply took an individual's model and extrapolated. And then, of course, it worked for a while because there was a period of relative stability in stock prices from about 55 to about 65, the 10-year period he was actually using his data. And you could actually keep it going out to about 73. But, of course, further on, the projections completely failed. And one of the main guys responsible for promoting it was a guy called Eugene Fama. And Fama then, in 2004, the capital asset pricing model, theory and evidence, he and French did the empirics on it, said it fails abjectly, it's extremely bad, it should never be used in practical circumstances. And as part of it, they said, not only, they didn't put it in these terms, they were very, as usual, cagey the way they say these things, but not only did Sharpe assume that we all shared the same expectations about shares for the future, we're sharing correct expectations. Okay. So the theory assumes we're all Nostradamus.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, of course, you don't read that in the textbook. They give you this mendacious presentation of the whole thing. But you go back and read the 64 paper where Sharpe dreamed up this leap from the individual to the collective, and the 2004 where Fama and French look back at it. Put the two together. We homogeneity of investor expectations where those expectations are correct. It's not a theory. It's a fantasy.
All right, right. So talking about, or on that note, let's talk about money creation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that most people, they have just a very poor understanding of how this actually works. Well, I would say the entire banking system. So what do most people get wrong about money or the creation of money? And then how should they think about it?
Well, I've actually thinking about our talk, recent talk, one thing that came to mind was the observation, if somebody's telling you about money and they don't explain it or they can't explain it using double entry bookkeeping, shut them up. They don't know what they're talking about because money is fundamentally a creature of double entry bookkeeping. So if you want to see how money is created, first we've got to define money accurately, and people say gold is money. Well, shut them down as well. Unless you can go shopping at the local supermarket and find all the prices denominated in grams of gold, which of course you can't. Equally, Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, money these days, they may take the place of money, but at the moment the money we use is money created by banks or money created by the government. And to understand it, you've got to look at the banking sector in the double entry framework. And fundamentally, money, aside from cash, which obviously cash can only be created by federal government, money is fundamentally the liabilities of the banking sector to the public.
Right.
Okay, that's money. So when you say how money is created and destroyed, you must be giving an explanation how the liabilities of the banking sector are increased or decreased. Mm-hmm. And if you're not doing that, you're bullshitting. And I've just recently seen a new article by Greg Mankiw and one other where they're explaining why government spending can crowd out the private sector, and their private sector is a bunch of yeoman farmers. Mm. I mean, give me a break. And it's all about effectively their money is effectively a form of corn. No, that is corny. That is not money.
So really, I think the biggest hurdle for people, and maybe you can explain this, they believe they see money as though it is a gold coin. Going back, let's go back to the 1800s with the American banking system, and started off with something called free banking, which isn't necessarily just free of charge. It's free of government intervention for the most part, where you would give your gold coin to the bank and they would store it for you, let's say in a vault. And then they would create an IOU. We had fractional reserve banking. That was something of the free market. Most people think that, in the free market, would just have full reserve banking. That's not quite true. So they would issue these IOUs, and they'd have a reserve requirement. And each bank was a little bit different. A lot of the banks issued their own currency. And so this was kind of this free free banking, excuse me. But it was based on these gold coins that the banking system would have, and then they would lend those out in full reserve, or they would create IOUs, paper IOUs, currency, if you will. But it was backed by this gold coin they had in the vault. And I think most people still see banking that way, where they wire their $100,000 to Bank of America, and then they assume Bank of America takes that $100,000 they just wired them and then lends it out to someone else to purchase a house and keeps 10% in reserve. So they lend out 90%. Mm-hmm. So why is that inaccurate? And if someone believes that, what's the problem there? Like how does that take them down a path to where they don't really understand the banking system and the way the economy really works?
Well, they're leaving out the capacity of banks to create money without needing reserves in the first place. And again, when people think they lend from reserves, I mean, I've seen that in minutes of the Federal Reserve. So I know that's what members of the Federal Reserve Board, all with PhDs in economics, think Wow. is actually what's going on. And when you look at it in double entry bookkeeping terms, it is simply impossible to lend from reserves unless you lend off balance sheet in cash. That's the only way that the fractional reserve banking system, so-called, actually works. And that's, again, why I say if you can't explain it using double entry bookkeeping, you can't explain it at all. And when you put what is seen as fractional reserve banking, even full reserve banking, you put that into the framework of double entry bookkeeping, it doesn't make sense. And it might be best, we talked about sharing my screen to illustrate some of the stuff. Would that help if I could do that right now?
Sure, you want to give it a shot?
Yeah, give it a try. So here we go. So I go to share screen. This is a software package I've designed called Minsky.
Yeah.
Named after Hyman Minsky, of course. And what it does is lets you model the financial system using double entry bookkeeping. So let's see if I and what I can do is I create an asset called reserves, for example, and another asset called loans. Okay. And then I have a liability. Say I have got one bunch here I call savers, and another bunch I call borrowers.
And I just want to point out, Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the liability in this case, we could also say that it's a deposit. It's a consumer deposit. So your checking account or your savings account at your local bank is a liability of the bank. So
that's
if you're
right.
a saver, you've got your $100 in the bank. That's your asset, but it's the bank's liability. So another way to call liability is a deposit of the commercial banking system.
So I'm going to have a saver deposit 100 here, which means you get 100 put down into reserves. And that's the sort of situation people often think banks start from. And then I can say, well, let's lend money. You know, let's lend money to the borrower. So you're going to lend money to the borrower. You've got to put some lend money in here. Okay, that's gone up. So, okay, well, let's have a, you're going to take the money and lend from the reserves. Only look over here. What Minsky is doing is imposing what's called the fundamental law of accounting, that assets minus liabilities minus equity equals zero. So every row you see must sum to zero. And what it's telling me here, I'm sorry, this is double counting. It's not lending, go creating to zero at all. If you want to show lending going on like that, then what you've got to do is this and say reserves go down and loans go up. But the only way that's going to happen and the borrower then going to, let's say we have pay interest on loan. So the borrower is now going to pay interest out of here and pay it to the bank. So that's working. But when you look at it, why on earth is somebody paying interest and they haven't got any money? The only way you can make sense of it is to say, well, the loan has been taken out as cash. So I come over here and I then say, let's look at the system from the point of view of the borrower here, who's now got a loan, which is negative. The only way this makes sense, if they have cash, which they've taken out of the bank, and I'll just call this cash of the borrower.
Yeah, or cash or a gold coin. I mean, if you
or
think
a gold
about
coin,
it,
it's a coin. Okay. So now if you do that, then yes, they got the loan, but they've got the loan in cash. Now, you were giving an example earlier of the old wildcat banks, as they were called. And yes, in some cases they would lend, you know, you'd go and take a loan and get their notes out the door. That's the sort of system you need to allow banks to create money by by reserve lending. But these days, what we do is you simply pay money straight to the borrower. You put money in their account, and what then happens is the loans go up by the amount lend. The interest goes, the amount of money in the bank account goes up by lend. So you create the money. You don't need to even touch the reserves.
Right.
So that is, I'll now get rid of the, I've got the setting up as cash over here. This would actually be the borrower's account. So I'd actually whack the borrower's account inside there. That's not going to give me an error there. So I've got to get rid of this one. Okay. And then you're paying the interest out of here. Okay, so that's now accountingly correct. Those two tables make sense. But what they're doing is they're showing lending and money creation and paying interest without involving reserves. So when you look at what's this idea about fractional reserve banking, it's another textbook myth. Okay, it's another way the textbook tries to tell you that money is created in such a way that they can ignore money in their economic theory.
Or they can ignore the importance of the commercial banking system.
Yeah, completely. I mean, if you look at any mainstream neoclassical economic model, certainly before the financial crisis in 2008, had no banks, no money, and no private debt in them.
Okay?
They thought that was a model of capitalism. No, it's a model of a funny system existing on another planet, which we don't happen to inhabit.
Yeah.
But what it means is in that world, they can say, well, the government controls money creation by deciding how many reserves to create and setting a required reserve ratio, and that's their explanation of money creation. And then using that explanation, Ben Bernanke blamed the Great Depression on the Federal Reserve not creating enough money, which looks plausible when you hear people demonizing the Federal Reserve, and I'm certainly not again people demonizing the Federal Reserve, I might add.
You're talking to a guy that's wearing an End the Fed hat.
I can see. You need a clearinghouse, but you don't need a vacuum cleaner like the Fed, which sucks in more ways than one. Let's keep the pun going. Because they're run by mainstream economists. But it's a textbook model. It's not the real world. And so what we have people is, a lot of people like, Mish Shedlock, for example, who's a good mate of mine. Mish is the other end of the political spectrum from me, if you know Mish Shedlock. But he was criticising fractional reserve banking all the time, saying, mate, it doesn't exist. It's a textbook model. You might as well be tilting at windmills, which is what it amounts to. So a lot of what we have, a lot of people's criticisms of capitalism and criticisms of the banking sector, the criticisms of textbook manifestations of both that are wrong.
Right. And that's the key takeaway here. So once we understand this, how can we better understand what the Fed is doing today with quantitative easing, or what they're not doing?
Yeah, well, that's a nice sort of one. Quantitative easing, when you look at it, what quantitative easing is doing, and I could continue on my model on screen, but I'll see if I can talk it through for people first of all. And if you think it's not a good enough explanation, let's go back to the Minsky table. But quantitative easing is buying bonds off the banking sector. So on a regular basis, because the Federal Reserve is trying to control the short interest rate, the rate they set, the 0% rate they have these days. It was as high as 17 under Bockler, as you and I would remember. Well, certainly I do. I think you're a bit younger than me, aren't you?
Maybe a little bit.
There you go. Okay. Well, I was around for the Bockler recession, at least in Australia. But the Federal Reserve is buying and selling bonds off the banks all the time, what they call open market operations, trying to maintain the interest rate within that band. So that's a regular thing to buy and sell bonds off the banks. With quantitative easing, what the Federal Reserve promised to do was to buy every month to be $80 billion on the buy side in those transactions, so that over a year it would be $1 trillion on the buy side. So it's buying $1 trillion worth of bonds off the private banks. Now, where do the private banks record their treasury bonds? As one of their assets.
Right.
Okay. So if you're buying $1 trillion worth of bonds off them, you're giving them $1 trillion in cash, which goes into the reserves. Okay, so reserves go up by $1 trillion, the bonds go down by $1 trillion. Now that's all happening on the asset side of the banking sector's ledger. Nothing
is happening
on the liability
side of the Fed.
Or the liability side of the Fed, correct? But actually, no, because the bonds are a liability of the Treasury.
I'm sorry, just the bank reserves on the
It's not, you can include the treasure in there as I do in more complicated models. But anyway, what it means is the operation is not, it's simply shuffling around what assets the banking sector has. It's not changing their liabilities, therefore it's not creating money. But then you have to say, well, what happens as a result of QE? Well, you, as a banking sector as a whole, you have $1 trillion less in bonds and $1 trillion more in cash. Now, bonds return interest rate, reserves do not. So you've got you've traded an interest earning for a non-interest earning asset. So that is encouraging the banks, and this is deliberately part of QE, to go and buy shares.
Yeah.
Now, if they go and buy shares, they're going to drive share prices up. And you're putting $1 trillion per year more buying pressure on the share market from the banking sector, and maybe more given all the leverage that goes on there as well. So that is going to inflate share prices. Now, if people who have shares sell their shares, then those shares they're selling, which are their assets, get converted into cash, and that turns up on the liability side of the banking sector if that money is deposited in the bank accounts. So the appreciation of the stock market, as much as it's realized by share speculators, that's where QE's money gets into the actual banking sector. And that is a large part of why we've seen asset price bubbles. The bubble, the Fed buying the shares in the first place, people realizing some of their gains there, all that, and then again, you get, you know, we all know that bankers who get very handsome fees, the 2 and 20 rules. So their profits as trading corporations, that also turns up in the liability side of the banking sector. So it's a way of creating money, but it's a very weak way of doing it. You talk about a multiplier effect, put in one, get 10 out. This is put in 10, get one out.
It's almost
like a divisor factor. So they could be getting much more bang for their buck if they gave that trillion directly to mortgagees, you know, which they could do. So rather than getting a trillion, then they might get 100 billion. That does cause some growth in economic activity.
Let me just back up there really quick. So yeah. I just want to put that in different terms. Instead of creating a trillion in base money and only getting 100 billion in broad money, you're saying they need to figure out a way, or what would be better is if they figured out a way to create the $1 trillion directly in the broad money supply, or M2, so it's circulating within the real economy instead of exclusively, or at least 90% of it, just circulating within the financial economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michael Hudson puts it beautifully. He says that the Fed's helicopter landed on Wall Street, not Main Street.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Let's talk about one of the transfer mechanisms, and this would be government spending. So we talked about if the transaction is exclusively between the Fed and the commercial banking system, then it's what our good buddy Jeff Snyder would just call an asset swap. But what happens if the government is deficit spending, and or let's call it that, you know, creating or sending out checks, and then they're selling bonds that the commercial banking system buy, you know, the primary dealer banks, and then 24 hours later they just flip them to the Fed, and the Fed creates additional reserves to buy those treasuries that now become an asset of the Fed, but then those checks go out in the mail So now we've got the real economy involved in what was just the financial economy between the Fed and the primary dealer bank, the commercial banking system. Now you've got those checks which become liabilities or additional deposits. So now we've created more broad money and we've created more base money. Am I thinking that through correctly?
Not quite. And that's why I recommend you get a copy of Minsky and start playing with it yourself, mate, because it's been designed for people to use, not just for me to give expertise. But I'll just go back and do share screening again.
Yeah.
And okay, so there's deficit spending. The money goes into the savers' bank accounts. And, of course, the reserves of the banking sector increase. So there's your deficit spending. Now, let's then say we've got the sell treasury bonds to cover it. So you sell bonds to the banks. We've got to have another account here, which I'm going to call bonds and bonds with underscore lowercase b for the bonds itself. So if you sell the bonds, then there's going to be bonds bought by the bonds by the banks or sold to the banks. That's there, bond sales to the banks. And that's going to mean that they use reserves to do it. So or ultimately, the money comes from the reserves. Mm. So what you've got there is the selling of the treasury bonds is an asset swap. That is occurring on the asset side of the banking sector. So the deficit itself increases the liability of the banking sector. The deficit itself, therefore, creates money. There's no need for the central bank to come in and do anything. Now, if you include the central bank and say the central bank buys bonds off the banks, then you're going to have, well, that's going to be minus bonds, which you are now buying from the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's going to mean the reserves go up. So the central bank operation also doesn't affect what's happening on the liability side of the banking sector.
Right. So the government's spending all, money.
It's all just another asset swap. So the creation of money is actually the deficit itself.
Right. Right.
Okay. And yep, then the question is how that is actually financed in the banking within the central bank and the treasury itself. If it's financed just by the treasury running up an overdraft on its account of the central bank, then there's no need to sell bonds in the first place.
Yeah, right.
You could simply do it that way. So all this, the bond sales do not create money, and the purchases by the central bank of bonds at the banks also do not create money. The only bond, actually, I might illustrate this because some of my Patreon supporters had a go at me for not including this, and it turned out they were right. I hadn't including sell bonds to the public, for example.
Well, I was just going to say that, Steve. We talked about two forms of money creation with the government spending, the commercial banking system, but then I had that on my notes. What about when the banking system buys or sells assets from an entity or individual in the real economy?
Okay, well, what we're going to have now, you're going to sell bonds. Now, of course, the banks are going to make a trading profit in doing that. That's the only reason they do it. So I'm going to have minus bonds sold by the banks to the public.
Yeah.
Okay, and let's say it's the savers who are doing it. Then they're going to do it by using their bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So that destroys money.
Yeah.
Okay, so bond sales by the banks, or anybody really, to the non-bank public destroys money. It doesn't create money. Now, what money is it destroying? Well, it's actually destroying part of the money that's created up here.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had 100% sale of bonds by the, let's say first of all, the Treasury sold all the bonds to the banking sector, which covered the deficit completely, and then the private bank sold all that to the non-bank public, there'd be no creation of money over here.
Yeah, so just putting this in as simple terms as I can, if the average listener or watcher, viewer, it has $100 in their checking account and you buy a $100 treasury from your bank, in order to pay for that, they're going to take your account balance from $100 down to $0.
Zero, yep.
That's destroying money because the bank isn't, that money doesn't go over to the bank at all. All they're doing is just reducing their liabilities. Now, the opposite would be true is if you sell $100 worth of treasuries to the banking system, then they would credit your deposit, your checking account, with $100. That would create additional money supply that did not exist before.
Yeah, yeah. But you've got to see it in double entry bookkeeping lens. If you don't see it through double entry bookkeeping, you're going to make a mistake. And that's why I've developed Minsky, to make it possible to do this stuff in a very careful way with an integrated look at the entire financial system. And it gives you a very, very different vision about how the financial sector should operate than if you think of money as a liability lacking object like gold, for example.
Yeah, right.
You're going to misunderstand money.
Yeah. So I'd love to go down the Bitcoin path here. because, you know, a lot of people have talked about Bitcoin being, let's say, base money, or replacing what gold did back with the banking system and lending off of Bitcoin. But that would, so what would the pros and the cons of that be, Steve? Or have you given that any thought?
Not particularly, because, okay. I mean, my hassle with Bitcoin is that it's not money. Okay, and money is only used for transactions. And in Bitcoin's, one of its many, what I see as design flaws, are the fact that it takes about 10 minutes to do the nonce calculation.
Right.
And the number of transactions is about, less than 10 per second globally. I think that they're down to about the 3 level right now. And because it's appreciating, you'd be a fool to use it to go shopping. So consequently, it's being used as a store of value, no doubt, no argument there, a very volatile one, but it's not being used as transactions. So until it's used for transactions, and on a monumental scale as well, it's not money. So I haven't imagined what's going to happen with lending, and I think it could be a pretty interesting experience if you start lending Bitcoin and its price is radically altering, mainly up and frequently down. It could be an exciting thing to be in debt in.
Yeah, I've given it some thought, and I don't know that it could be lent, or anyone would borrow it if it wasn't transactional, because it would have to be transactional to reduce the volatility, because it would have to be more widely adopted. So it's a little bit of an interesting paradox there. But let's move on to something that we discussed in our last conversation, because I think you wanted to use your software to kind of think this through. And this is a more complex question. And I want to give full credit to Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein. I know Bill's been trying to think through this issue on their podcast called The End Game. And the issue I'm referring to is Japan, in the sense that the Bank of Japan owns about 60% of the government debt. So what they were trying to think through is, okay, well, this is an asset on the balance sheet of the central bank. It's a liability on the balance sheet of the government. And those are the only two parties involved here. We're not talking about the additional 40% that's outstanding held by the private sector. We're just talking about that 60%. So what if one morning someone came into the central bank and accidentally hit the delete button on the 60% of the government debt? Would anyone even know if they didn't
it's
the media?
It's an internal transaction inside the government. And I'd actually encourage Bill and Co. to get a copy of Minsky, download it for free from SourceForge, and do their explorations there, because they could actually work out the quite complicated internal dynamics of that.
Yeah, their thought, though, Steve, is if the market finds out that the BOJ did that, would they sell off yen? Would the existing 40%, would they sell those? Would they buy? How would that affect the markets as far as the psychology and the emotion that we talked about before?
Well, actually, that's where you come back to that initial thing I was showing you with when the government runs a deficit. How do the banks find the money to buy the bonds? And of course, it's quite complicated, because you have the bonds are being bought by primary dealers and so on, some of whom are banks, others are not banks. So the non-bank primary dealers would need to borrow reserves off the banks to do the buying of the bonds. But right. fundamentally, as well as the deficit creating liabilities for the banking sector, it creates an identical level of assets for the banking sector as reserves. So when it comes to buying those bonds, when the bonds are offered for sale to the private sector, let's take the standard situation where reserves earn no interest and bonds earn some interest. What they're being offered is an asset swap of a zero return asset for a plus positive return asset. Mm-hmm. And the money's been created by the deficit in the first place. So whether you want to be a vigilante or not, you'd be a fool not to take advantage of that offer. And that's what tends to happen. Now, we've got some pretty curvy situations now. We actually get negative yields standing up because of some of the bond with bid levels that have come through. But fundamentally, the basic story applies. You are making a swap out of a non-income earning asset into an income earning one. Even if you're paying a negative return on it,
that's right.
it's an asset you
that's
can right. you can buy and sell on the market. In a way, you can't buy and sell cash.
And you can rehypothecate it. And guys, just to put that into today's news, if you hear a lot of CNBC talking heads, Bloomberg, talking about how the short end of the yield curve could go negative in the United States, that is a result of there not being enough T-bills, believe it or not, compared to the amount of bank reserves. So those primary dealer banks, they have that those bank reserves we talked about through quantitative easing, they're not getting any return on it at the Fed, maybe 10 basis points. But they can take those bank reserves, buy T-bills, and then they can rehypothecate them, let's say 10 times, and create a far greater yield by owning that pristine collateral than they can with those bank reserves. So it distorts the market in that way as well.
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually the trading activities that bonds facilitate, which you can't do with reserves. So that's a major reason why you can actually see negative rates turning up in the weird circumstances we're in now. But it's still going to be profitable for banks to do that out of the rehypothecation process they can't do unless they buy the bonds in the first place. Fundamentally, I think you'd find that it could happen overnight and there would be no effect on the government itself because it's all an internal operation, and the markets would continue as always because the money that they use to buy the bonds is being created by the deficits in the first place, and they're not going to turn down a profitable potential purchase of bonds with reserves. They're not going to rule themselves out of the rehypothecation market, which they would do if they didn't actually buy the bonds in the first place.
Yeah, so if it's just a bookkeeping entry and nothing would detrimental, let's say, would happen to the yen or the rest of the outstanding bond market, does that mean we've created, we've financially engineered a free lunch for the government?
Because fundamentally, the government does have a free lunch.
Then they could go out and spend, drop their GDP down, or debt to GDP down to, let's say, 100%. So now they could go and spend up to 200% again, and it's just free, whether they did infrastructure spending, whether they did, or does the government spending in and of itself matter as far as the way money is spent?
What the government spends this money on does matter. So if you look at what happened in Japan, two people talk about freeways to nowhere, six-lane freeways to a fishing village and back again, simply as a way of pumping money into the economy because it was so depressed after the bubble economy burst back in 1990. And that's a wasteful way for government to create money. And I am skeptical of bureaucrats. So I don't want to see bureaucrats controlling spending as much as possible. But I do want to see governments providing the money, creating the money the rest of us use for commerce. And the best way for them to do that is to do things which we necessarily need at a social level. And you don't want to have, for example, education, I think, should be paid for by the state. Health should be paid for by the state. How it's delivered is another matter entirely. But the government funds students, the government funds hospitals, and then we then use the money created in that sense. And if you think about it, giving students a scholarship, the students go and spend in the private sector. So in this sense, government is one of two major forms of money creation, the other being the banking sector. Mm. The banking sector is hardly a bunch of angels in how they've created money, what they've created it for. But I think a lot of people who obsess about the government's role ignore that side of things and pretend the finance sector is you know, a bunch of angels, and don't realize when the government, when the banking sector creates money, it creates a liability for the borrower at the same time. And that is what can actually, that to me is what is the main cause of financial crises, is excessive levels of private debt. But the government, when it creates money, it creates a debt for itself internally, as we've discussed a moment ago, but it doesn't create a debt for the person who gets it. So in that sense, fiat money is debt-free money for the recipient. And when you have a lot of that, your commerce runs on that fiat cash. And we had a more effective capitalism in the 50s and 60s when that was happening at a rate of about 2 or 3% of GDP deficit every year on average, fairly volatile, but about at least 2% on average. That created the money the rest of us used for commerce. And that was the golden age of capitalism, with a very low level of private debt, very high government debt falling nonetheless at the same time as this fiat money was being created. But it's a sensible way to create the money the rest of it use in capitalism.
So let's move on, and I think that transitions beautifully into an idea you have of a private debt jubilee. We talked about the sovereign debt jubilee of Japan. But walk us through your idea with a private sector debt jubilee and how you would get around the potential moral hazard.
Yeah, well, let's start with the reason why I see it is vital. We have the highest level of private debt probably in the history of humanity, certainly in the history of American capitalism at the moment. And that debt level, that's the booms and busts of that debt are what caused the Great Depression, it caused the Great Recession. All that sort of speculative excess is a major part of why capitalism has been in a funk ever since 2008. So the level of private debt now is about 160% of GDP. And if you look back at the golden age of capitalism, it was between 40 and 70% of GDP. So to get back to the golden age, I would do what I call a modern debt jubilee. And that is not creating money, it's exchanging credit-based money for fiat-based money. So I would give let's just take a set of round figures. Give every adult American $100,000. If they have debt, they must pay their debt down by the $100,000. If they don't have debt, they get cash. I would also, leaving aside the need to stimulate the economy right now during and after COVID, if you wanted to eliminate any macroeconomic impact of that, I would say the people who don't have any debt would be required to buy corporate shares, where they were newly issued corporate shares that the corporate sector had to use to pay down corporate debt. Because roughly speaking, they're roughly the same level. I mean, corporate debt has risen quite substantially during COVID, so has household debt, but they're roughly about 80% of GDP each. So if you did this, you'd reduce corporate debt and household debt to about 40 to 60% of GDP, be back in the golden age range of capitalism, and you'd reverse one of the major mistakes that the Fed has made with QE, which of course is making existing shareholders much wealthier and doing bugger all for those who don't own shares, which I think is a large part of where the political angst in America is coming from now. People feel disenfranchised. This would re-enfranchise people and give people a stake in capitalism.
So how do we make sure that we're not creating purchasing power a lot faster than we're creating the supply of goods and services? Therefore, the only thing we get with that, not the only thing, but one of the, maybe the downsides to that debt jubilee would be consumer price inflation.
Well, if you set it up in such a way that the people who are, if you think about people who borrowed money and people who didn't borrow money. Okay. So the ones who borrowed, the reason I came up with the idea of a modern debt jubilee like this was people said, well, if you forgive the debt, you benefit those who speculated against those who didn't speculate. So my idea is to give it to everybody, regardless whether they're in debt or not. And then the debtors get their debt reduced, but the non-borrowers, non-speculators get a cash injection. Now, if you said that cash had to be used to buy shares, you would create no spending power.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yeah. I was just thinking that cash, I was taking it just to the first step where that cash, if you don't have any debt, you get the $100,000. That increases your purchasing power for goods and services. And if that's not keeping up, you know, because we talked about that with a lot of the supply chain disruption in the United States and how that's creating an environment where we have fewer goods and services right now, and therefore some of the, you know, the price inflation that we're seeing in the U.S. So talking about price inflation, let's talk about the Aussie housing market. I think that's just a fascinating kind of case study, and it's something that I think Americans should look at, because we might be going down that same path to a certain degree. And I'm not talking about just the housing market. I'm talking about putting all of our economic eggs in one basket and just trying to kick that can down the road, and how that kind of hollows out the manufacturing base, and it hollows out the fundamental power and the structural soundness of an economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens. Happened in Australia. We have, Australia has expensive house prices and bugger all else. The manufacturing sector has been completely, not completely destroyed. There's still a reasonable but very small manufacturing sector. When you look at the complexity of Australia's manufacturing sector, it's roughly equivalent to Senegal. It can't produce a lot of things. It doesn't have a lot of the you know, intermediate goods you need for various forms of production. So it's a hollowed out system, as you say, because all the money has gone into house prices.
Right.
Now, America, certainly in the aftermath of COVID, and given the massive disruptions on the supply chain with China, you need companies to be investing. The companies to be investing, they've got to have low levels of private debt. And at the moment, they've got astronomical levels of private debt. And that's the danger. With that high level of private debt, you're unlikely to see the investment you need to rebuild the manufacturing sector so you can make stuff in America. So unless you reduce the level of corporate debt, you're in a pickle.
Yeah, but see, then what they do, they don't think that through. They, the central planners, let's say, the politicians, the central bankers, and they just say, okay, let's just double down on housing. Or in the United States, let's just double down on the stock market. Let's just double down on the stock market. And they keep doubling down until the entire economy is built around the stock market, or the entire economy is built around housing. And at some point, that house of cards has to come down. And when it does, you have no economy left.
Yeah, and that's the great danger. We've got into financial engineering so much, we've forgotten about real engineering. And real engineering requires physical monetary investment. And if the banks aren't providing the money for it, and the corporate sector is massively in debt as it is now, then you're not going to see much of that investment taking place. Or if it does, it's much more fragile, because if you don't get the return you expect, then you're going to be going bankrupt, which is the last thing you want to have, you know, a massive corporation is doing right now. And I don't know, actually, I might just do a bit of a screen share again if I can.
Sure.
Here, George, just quickly, just to illustrate the level of private debt I've got. This is including government debt as well. But this is the recent situation for America, for private debt, starting from back in the 1950s up to a peak in 2008, now rising again because of COVID. Government debt is actually less than private debt, even given the amount it's increased in under COVID. But the interesting one for me is actually the blue line. That's corporate debt. And you can see corporate debt was down. I've actually just traced it and checked and see what the level was back then. Corporate debt was about 20%. 22% of GDP, in the 25% of GDP to 30% in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And then it's risen quite substantially and is now at 85% of GDP. Now, I wanted to get it back to about the sort of level back over here, about the 40% level. And at that level, it's possible to imagine people borrowing money to build factories. Which is what you need.
When you're talking about the corporate debt, though, Steve, the first thing that comes to my mind is going back to the Federal Reserve, and I go straight back to March 2020, where the Fed comes in and basically puts a backstop to the entire corporate debt market. They come in and through special purpose vehicles, they not only buy corporate debt, but they buy junk debt. Corporate debt. So then what do the corporations do? They just borrow more. They say, well, shoot, if the Fed's going to come in and backstop the market to where interest rates are at historic lows, I'm going to borrow as much money as I possibly can. So you get you have this perverse incentive process that's set up by the Fed and all these unintended consequences.
And that's why you've got to go beyond just the idea of a modern debt jubilee that I spoke about earlier. I also want to bring in various reforms to the nature of the stock market that mean that it actually promotes capital formation, not leverage and capital destruction, which is what's happening right now. So I would, like, you know, 99% of the trades on the market or more are secondary share sales. They're not raising capital for anybody. IPOs are trivial as part of the overall market. You're so right. I would want to change shares, the ownership of shares, so that when a share was initially issued, it would last forever, as shares do now. But after a number of sales, you could vary how many sales were allowed, it would have a 50-year life.
Huh.
And at that point, anybody who bought the share was buying an annuity, and you'd be a fool to pay a speculative price for an annuity. So something like that that makes it more attractive for companies to issue shares on the market and get IPOs and initial capital coming in that way, but unattractive to gamble and speculate on the shares over the long term.
Yeah. You know, I think I've got such a huge edge coming into the investment space as a retired entrepreneur, because I was, you know, I was never a big business owner, but I had several small and kind of mid-sized businesses. Yeah. And I always use the example of when I would look at potentially buying a McDonald's franchise. Mm-hmm. And I never want, if the business broker came to me and gave me the P&L, let's say, in the balance sheet, I would never think to myself, well, what can I sell this McDonald's for in 3 months?
I mean, no, that's right.
It never even would be laughable. Mm-hmm. I sit there and I look and I say, okay, well, what's the bottom line? All right, this little McDonald's is producing $100,000 worth of cash a year. They're asking $1 million. So how much do I need to borrow to get that done? So what's my cash return going to be? You know, how can I improve the business? How can I grow it over time? Because I want to keep this as an, I'm buying a business, for heaven's sakes. I'm not just buying a piece of paper that I want to sell in 3 months for a higher price to a greater fool. And I think we've just completely lost that concept.
We have, and that's you know, financial capital has taken over, and mainstream economics has played a major role in letting that happen by all the mythological stuff they write about how the stock market functions, you know, efficient markets hypothesis we spoke about earlier. So I want to see genuine industrial capitalism come back. And that's where when you invest, as you say, you won't sell it in 3 months' time. There's a wonderful mathematical economist, a mathematician actually, who decided to take economics, called John Blapp. And he talked about what happens on the share market as not being investment, but placement. You're placing a bet.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And therefore, you know, you bet you want to turn them over as fast as possible. That's not investment. Investment is where you have a long-term commitment. And you're expecting to make profit out of cash flow, not over the price appreciation in the short term. And Keynes said the same thing. He said there's no such thing as liquidity for an economy. If you're invested in steel, then you're invested in steel. You can't suddenly be invested in steel one day and tulips the next. And yet the mentality we've got is as if you can do that and as if that would be a good thing. And both are false.
Yeah. All right, Steve, I know I've kept you over our hour. I appreciate your time, as always. Such a fascinating conversation. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Okay, the best place is my Patreon page. I get support from patrons, obviously. My patrons actually told me they wanted most of my posts to be free. Mm. So if you don't want to pay me money, you can still go and read my views at www.patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen.
Awesome, Steve. Thanks again. I can't wait to do it soon.
Thank you, mate. Good to talk.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.